So, Tibor, the floor is now yours.
Well, thank you very much, Holly and Dan and Dan. Welcome, everybody, for this colloquium. And I think it will be a very different kind of colloquium from the previous ones, because the topic area is not your usual topic area. The title of the presentation is called Design Space for Space Design, which is the title of my thesis that I'm working on currently at the Royal College of Art. And the subtitle is Cybernetics, Human-Centered Design at NASA. So I will cover a lot of material here, and it will be just touching on key areas, but I won't get too deep into any of these. But hopefully it will give you a taste there about what I've been working on the past 4 years and why I'm doing it and how I believe it can be beneficial for NASA. So on the front page, you can see a sculpture that I did just this year called the Galileo Flow Field, and it shows the Galileo probe and the velocity profiles around it, the velocity contours goes around it. And this is, I call, a boundary object, and I will tell you about it more once we get to the later part of the presentation and why I believe boundary objects can be useful for our work. If you go to the next slide, my experience is that we have some challenges at NASA. So I believe that we have a very strong engineering technology-driven paradigm, and in this paradigm, we have certain constraints, and within these constraints, we try to do certain things, we repeat the same talking points year after year, hoping that something will change, but at the same time, we have this very specialized language that limits innovation, because we are in that boundary, in that paradigm of the language that is provided to us. So we have to do something to come up with different potential outcomes, and my research is targeting that. If you go to the next slide, slide three. So I will start with innovation barriers. In 2010, I went to NASA headquarters, the Office of the Chief Technologist, and worked there for 1 year and converted into a Space Technology Mission Directorate. And I was the program executive for the Game Changing Development Program for 2 years, from 11 to 13. And during that time, we had a $160 million annual budget program with over 60 projects in it. And the idea was to develop innovative new technologies. So I was curious how we can do innovation better, and that initiated my research at the Royal College of Art on the side as a part-time correspondent researcher, and I was still working at headquarters. But I started to look into, you know, what is innovation, how we can do innovation better, what are the barriers for innovation, and what can we do about this. If you go to the next slide, in 2010, OCT did the space technology roadmaps. And as a response to that, the National Research Council responded back with a statement, well, with a report, but they were saying that NASA's technology base is largely depleted and future success will depend on advanced technology developments. And I reported, many of the analysis and further information in papers, and provided in reference a list of papers that you can find and read upon if you are interested in more details. So if you go to the next slide, slide five, in response to this NRC report, NASA chief technologists, center chief technologists, started a study and to look into what are the innovation barriers. And the report is not published, but the findings pointed to some key areas. NASA has a risk-averse culture. There's a low priority on innovation, which is combined with short-term focus. There's instability, mostly caused by the financial, the fiscal instability. There are lack of opportunities. We have all these missions logged into 3-year, 5-year, 10-year durations, and then by the time we get to your destination, it takes another several years. So because all the money is logged in, there is a limit of what else we can do beyond these logged in portfolios. There's a process overload, which is combined with the risk-averse culture. There are communication challenges. There are 10 different NASA centers around the country. If there are mixed teams, you have to communicate across the country. You have external subcontractors, we have to work with them, and that can provide a challenge. And of course, there's an organization inertia. There is a large workforce at NASA, and change anything around, it's like steering a big ship, it's not that easy. If you go to the next slide, slide six, industry and innovation principles identified certain ways to overcome some of these barriers. And this, you know, it's public domain literature. One of them is creative ideation, which is bootlegging. For example, Google and 3M used to do this, allowing their workers to work 5-10% of their time on something that is near to their heart. And then, you know, that would benefit the organization at the end. Innovation laboratories and creative spaces. JPL has the Innovation Foundry, and TeamX, probably you're familiar with TeamX, is one of the elements of the Innovation Foundry, and I will get to that later on. Innovation funding, for example, IRAD funding or Space Technologies Center Innovation Funds, when you give money to organizations and they perform. Or Skunkworks kind of environments, when you have a small group, well-funded group, protected from the outside influences, and they can innovate within that bubble, within that environment. Or you can combine many of these together. So these are good examples, and NASA is trying to do some of these. But I figured I have to have a better understanding of the bigger picture. This is still the project level, still the program level, and there are other forces potentially which can influence innovation, not only these band-aid solutions and then kind of quick fixes. If you go to the next slide, that's where I came across wicked problems. And I applied wicked problems for space technology development when I looked at a much broader picture than just a portfolio of a program or the project itself within the program. So wicked problems were established by Richter and Weber a long time ago on the social sciences, and it's an over-constrained problem. So there's no clear solution for it because the drivers are different, they're competing drivers. You have to pick a direction, go down, and there are outcomes from that direction that you picked. And you cannot really blame the leaders to go this way or that way because it's based on strategy, based on tactics. And so there are 10 points that they identified which are characterizing wicked problems. And I don't want to go back to the whole list, but if you go to the backup slide, you will have a list, a subset of that you can look at, and you will understand better what wicked problems are. If you go to the next slide, to understand the wicked problems, I started to look into NASA's budget. And I did this analysis a couple of years ago, so I used the FY13 budget. And the first slide is the federal budget. And in that year, the U.S. government had a $3.45 trillion federal budget. And it is divided into multiple parts. One part was discretionary, which is about one-third of the budget, and then two-thirds was non-discretionary that you cannot touch. But the non-discretionary was Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, interest, and such. And discretionary that you can touch and you can kind of cut from the government side was defense-related discretionary, as usually they don't touch, and the remaining was the non-defense-related discretionary. And out of that $576 billion, NASA got $16.86 billion. So out of that $3.45 trillion, NASA got $16.86 billion, which is 0.49% of the federal budget. So that shows the priority within the government, how important we are to them. And compare it to the Apollo era, the heyday of the Apollo era in 1966, when NASA got 4.4% of the national budget. So we are getting 9 times less money. Yes, we are expected to perform the same kind of large project like the Apollo program was. It's not really possible, and it provides a big challenge for us. So if you go to the next slide.
Tibor, this is Harley. I want to point out something here to the folks who are listening in now, that it is commonly stated, and as far as it goes, correct, that NASA's total budget is around 0.5%, much less than 1% of the total federal budget. Which is a statement that is, as your chart points out here, enormously misleading for policymakers and folks who follow NASA's budget. NASA's budget is a significant fraction of that part of the budget that we have the political leaders have some control over. It is not a mere 0.5% of the total federal budget, which includes lots of things that are very difficult, if not impossible, to control. It's a significant fraction of that which can be controlled. 2.7, almost 3% of the discretionary budget is a significant fraction, and we are fighting to keep that fraction against some very, very popular and powerful programs.
Yeah, you're correct there. So this is the overall, the related to overall budget, and within discretionary, it's about, you know, 2.5-3%. Yeah, that's correct.
Correct. Thank you, Tibor.
Yeah. So if you go to the next slide, it shows a further breakdown, how that 16.86 billion is broken down within NASA. It was 2 years ago. Now this year, the budget is 19.3 billion, so a little bit higher, but the proportions are relatively similar. So out of that, about 4.7 million to science mission directorate, a half a billion went to aeronautics, 0.6 went to space technology, and 7.4 to human exploration, and some other ones as well, across agency support and such. So, but if you further break it down, you can break down science mission directorate to planetary science, earth sciences, astrophysics, heliophysics, James Webb Space Telescope. So by the time you break it down, for example, planetary gets about a billion, roughly. And out of that, you break it down to Mars program and the rest of the solar system. So when you break down the budget into these elements, everything is pretty much locked in. So that shows that we don't have the flexibility to actually just whip out another couple of $100,000 for a new project, because the portfolios are locked in, the projects are locked in, we are planning this. And to get this budget, we have to go through a planning exercise. So if you go to the next slide, this planning exercise and also getting the budget is called the PPB process, which is the planning, programming, budgeting, and execution. And it's about a 2.5-3-year-long project. It starts with planning and programming when NASA headquarters works with NASA centers to try to figure out what kind of content we want to develop. And then we work with executive branch, OMB and OSPP, and we work on the president budget request side. So once we get that, we have a pass back, so we get back the budget, and then we send that over to the Congress side. And that's happening towards the end of the, you know, first year. And then the Congress sits on it for a while. They deliberate on that. If everything goes well, at the end of the second year, we get the budget back, and we have 1 year to execute. But by the time it goes from the president budget request to the Congress side, when we get the appropriated budget, they can earmark it, they can change it, and by the time we get it back, it's slightly different from whatever was in the present budget request that we initially negotiated. So we have this fast turnaround adjustment, and then we provide this funding to NASA centers, and then they can perform and they can implement the project and then work on the project. So it's a 3-year project, and it's very involved, and it's overlapping. So when we are working on 1 year and you're planning for the other one, you're executing the third one, it's a very involved process. And very dynamic, but there are some uncertainties because the budget changes every year. The government makeup is changing regularly. Because if you go to the next slide, you can see a very busy slide. You can see the executive branch when you have the OMB and OSTP. The president is elected every 4 years. If you go to the legislative branch side, you have the Senate and the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives are changing every 2 years. Senators are kind of elected every 6 years, which changes the makeup of the committees who are voting on the budget, and the priorities change regionally and also project-wise about what they are favoring. And the priorities, what they would like to see, are different from the legislative side and also from the executive branch side. And then it comes to NASA, and NASA would like to explore the solar system with humans or with robotic means. And we have 4 mission directorates. The mission directorates are working down with the program offices at the 10 NASA centers. And the program offices work with the projects. So it's a very involved, complex scenario when at every level, the drivers are different. The executive branch would like to do something great for the nation. The legislative branch often are influenced by jobs at their states and how much money comes to their states. NASA would like to work with the government and also with the NASA centers. The NASA centers would like to get the money from NASA headquarters so they can work on their projects. And we also have the external factors, other government agencies, academia, the public and industry we're working with, and the national academies who are providing advocacy to NASA and also to the government. So as you can see, we have a wicked problem here because every level you have different drivers, different interests, and there is no one single solution which is best. You have to pick something and you have to go with that. So because of that, I called it that NASA has a spatially and temporally coupled cyclical wicked problems. Spatially coupled because you have 10 NASA centers, temporarily coupled because you have all these cycles about 2 years, 4 years, 6 years. Missions can take 10 years to build, another 5 years or so to get to your destination, and you have to plan for those ahead. And since everything is changing cyclically every year, the budget is changing, you have to respond to that. It makes it very difficult to manage the project. So this part of the discussion was from a strategic level to try to explain the complexities that we have at NASA headquarters to get the money, hand it over, hand it down to our projects and programs so they can perform, and try to come up with a continuity to advance the discourse, advance the process, and develop these technologies and develop the missions that can help us to explore our universe. So go to our next slide. After this kind of big picture overview, I'd like to say a few words about paradigms and how cybernetics and design can help us in this endeavor. If you go to the next slide, slide 13, I'd like to mention Levy's second order of change. In this model, we have a paradigm, and NASA has a very engineering and technology-driven paradigm. Within the paradigm, we have a mission. We'd like to explore our solar system robotically and with humans. We have our NASA culture, and within that, we have our core processes, the 7120.5 and 7120.8. If you go to notice, you have pages and pages of documents explaining all the processes we have to follow. But we are pretty much staying in this paradigm, and we've been in this paradigm for the past 50 years. And because our language is specialized, our approaches are specialized and refined, and these barriers are rolling in. We have to make some changes. We cannot stay in the paradigm if we want to introduce new ideas. So to introduce new ideas, we have to change our discourse or broaden our discourse. And then in that case, we can find new perspectives, and then we can broaden the paradigm. And once we have a broadened paradigm, then that can help us to achieve, to find new directions and work towards novel outcomes. So if you go to our next slide, it talks about cybernetics, and I'm not getting, too deeply into cybernetics, but I'd like to mention that cybernetics and design can be two of the areas that we could introduce to our current engineering, technology, and management-driven paradigm that can help us to broaden our paradigm to introduce new ideas. And very simply put, cybernetics is circularity, how we interact with the world, how we interact with our environment, and what are the forward loops, what are the return loops, and how we can control these, how we can broaden the possibilities, how we can control the possibilities. And if you look at these three elements, you have a regulator who can be, for example, a project manager who is working through a process and operates within an environment. So the regulator, the manager, can control the process, which eventually helps to control the environment, and the feedback helps the project manager to understand what to do about it or how the environment responded, how the process responded. And the importance here is on the connections. It's not on the boxes. It doesn't really matter who is in the regulatory box or what the process is, but we have to focus on the connection, how these boxes are connected, what kind of dialogues we can facilitate, and how these dialogues can help us our understanding, what do we want to control, or do we want to broaden in cybernetic sense for the variety of the environment. So cybernetics can provide a perspective about how to see the environment, how to see our world. And design, if you go to the next slide, can help us with rules, what to do about this. And engineers are doing it very well. Engineers are doing a controlling approach. And in this chart, you have this double diamond that designers used to mention all the time. But what engineers do very often is look in the center dot, which is a specific problem. We have a specific problem that we want to answer with level one requirement. For example, you are given a task to build a bridge. The engineer would say, okay, I know how to build a bridge. We have two banks. I just put some pillars in between, or maybe a suspension bridge. So do a divergence, which is identifying different bridge types. And then we figure which one we want to do. And there's a convergence phase, which goes to the right side of the dot. Then actually we pick that one best possible solution for a bridge and then design that bridge and then build it. Now what designers would do is go to the left side of this chart to try to identify what is the generic problem. The question is not what kind of bridge you want to build, but the question is actually do you need a bridge? What is the problem that you are trying to solve? And let's explore that first. Let's have an exploration, a discovery of that question. And once we identify different possibilities, then focus down to that one specific problem that we actually want to solve. So there's this precursor analysis, this precursor assessment phase that identifies the right problem. And once you have the specific problem, then you can actually apply your skills, engineering and technology skills, to actually come to a conclusion. So, and again, I don't get too much into a design and cyber phase, but through the examples I'm providing, hopefully you can understand better what I was talking about. So that's why, if you go to the next slide, that's why we are coming to one of the first of the three examples. The first example is how to change organizational processes through cybernetics and design. I call this fracture points because these are fractures which are may or may not be visible, but if you make changes there, you can end up with a better outcome. So if something is broken, you want to fix it. That's a very clear fracture point. But if you are sitting in a very defined paradigm, you may not see that there can be some change there that you can fix. And someone can come in from the outside saying, if you change this and that, actually you might be able to better off. And then that's what I was trying to do here, applying cybernetics and design for strategic decision making. So with a colleague of mine at NASA headquarters, we developed this tool called Project Assessment Framework to Design. If you go to the next slide, slide 17, this one shows a typical project reporting approach. You have a technology that you are developing, you go from the ideation phase down to the use. So you go through different stages, you go through ideation, designing, building, testing, and using it. So the first couple of boxes that can bubbles are early stage development, looking into feasibility. Then you come to a designing, building, and testing that comes into the mid-tier of valley of death kind of development level. And then you go to technology demonstration, and finally you go to the operational phase. At every stage, if you encounter some kind of problem, you can throw some money at it, some time at it if you want to fix the problems. You go to a previous stage, iterate, and then eventually get your final solution. Hopefully you will be within your baseline configuration, baseline performance, and then you have your technology developed. So this is a very first order cybernetic approach, which is the observed system. A project manager looks at the project. Marching orders are given. You have your money, you have your schedule, you have your goals set out, you have your rules and regulations, engineering or management related tasks, and you operate within the paradigm. And your job is to keep everything on track. You don't really want to change anything because your marching orders are given. So this is an observed system first of the cybernetics. As you go to the next stage, the challenge here is that once you go to a strategic level, you have to look at this from a different perspective. You are not a project manager anymore. You are a strategic leader. So you have to look into what are the possibilities, what are the options, what are the threats, what are the outside influences over and above the project performance. So because of that, we decided to develop this tool, which is a very unique tool, which is systematically assesses project performance from a strategic level. So go to the next slide, slide 19. It's a bit busy slide, but on the right side, you can see an organizational chart with a typical org chart. This one shows Space Technologies org chart with the associate administrator at the top, with different groups, resource management, communications, operations, strategic integration. Then you have the program offices, and you have the projects on there. Now, the interesting thing is that you can put names into these boxes, and org charts are typically focusing on those names and boxes and how they are connected. What cybernetics is doing is focusing on the links. The important thing is how these boxes are communicating, and is it working the right way it's supposed to work. So there was a guy, Stafford Beer, who in the 1970s came up with a viable system model, which is a management cybernetics model. When he looked at the organization as a living system, if you look at the left side, it said, okay, well, if you look at the human body, it is also an organization. And actually, this human body model came from two researchers from Chile, Maturana and Valera. But Stafford Beer also used this model as an example when he developed his viable system model. So he said, for the first level of system one, we have the body parts, muscles and organs. Then you have the nervous system as system two. Then you have the brain functions, which almost like a strategic function. When you oversee the body's operation, that's system three. System four is communicating with the environment, communicating with the world through your sensory perception. And then you have system five, which is the higher brain function, which is your identity. And if you translate it to an organization, and especially within NASA, I translate it to the Space Technology Mission Directorate, you can see that system one, you have your project. Then you have system two, which are the program offices, where you have the tactical planning, and they are working very closely together, and the projects can work with external entities, with external contractors. And then you come to NASA headquarters, which are these brown boxes. System three is the resource office and analysis and planning. Then you go to system four, where you have the program executives and the communications office. It's the level one office, where you have the intelligence. And then you have system five, which is the senior leadership. And all of these are connected. And if you look at how projects are reporting up to headquarters, the system one in connection with system two come to headquarters and report on project performance. And it is very important to get that information, but we believe that it's not enough, because just because the project performs, they are on track, and they are doing a very good job, it's not the only information the senior leader should know before making a decision on the project itself. So we didn't have a process in the past for that. We had an ad hoc method when senior leadership went for meetings and they heard something or someone told them something, but there was no systematic assessment of the strategic relevant information that actually feeds into the project reporting, and combined they provide information that can help a senior leadership. So if you go to the next slide, there's a very simple explanation how this whole PFTD tool works. So you have an analyst on the left side with the A in the circle, and the analyst interviews all the levels, interviews the project people, the strategic people from the resource office to the program executive, also the executives, the external contractors as well, and asking questions about usability, feasibility, viability, and assemble this information to this big package. Then the next step, the analyst reduces the information to the most important key elements that the senior leader should know about the project from a strategic level, and then briefs the senior leader, system five, which allows the senior leadership to broaden the understanding of the project above and beyond the linear project reporting. So in that case, the strategic leaders can make more educated choices about which direction the project could go. If the project overrun, should we build them out? Shall we shut them down? Or what are the impacts in addition to how they are performing? So the analyst is not making decisions. Analyst is providing information to senior leadership, and it's up to senior leadership based on their strategy to decide what they want to do with the project. So if you go to the next slide, so we apply this tool to a number of projects in the mid-tier and high-tier level, and we brief senior leadership on the health of the project, and it allows them to make a better decision, hopefully a more educated decision on the outcome, on the kind of future of the project, or funding it, or cutting it, or bailing them out, or so on. So with this project, we demonstrated that cybernetics and design approaches can be very beneficial if you apply it with an organization. So this was the first example. The second example, if you go to 22, is space habitat. And I will go through it very quickly. This picture I'm showing here is a chair I built. It's a tensegrity chair, which I call the cybernetic astronaut chair, where you can have two people sitting on it back to back, one of them in the top, other one is kind of the seat is facing downwards towards the floor. But in zero gravity, you don't have up or down. So basically, you can occupy it with two people and then float around and have a home away from home, have that kind of comfortable feeling away. But I will get to this later on. The point here is that if you go to the next slide, that we are trying to go to Mars. We have the Evolvable Mars campaign. This is the latest way we are planning our future next 20 years. And we go from the low Earth orbit part to a cislunar space to eventually go to the moons of Mars and then to the surface of Mars and return humans safely. And we have to have technologies to develop that enables us, and a stepping stone approach, we can develop these technologies, build the previous steps, and eventually take humans there. So in that case, it's flexible. It's a flexible path approach. So if you have to change the destinations in between, it allows us to be flexible about that. So we try to go to Mars, and going to Mars is a long three-year mission. It's about 1,100 days. That's what we are looking into right now. And certain approaches that we have for low Earth orbit are working for long-duration space missions, but we have to actually go beyond our current approaches because it's not anymore an engineering and technology solution. So if you go to the next stage, on the ISS, astronauts are doing an excellent work. They are doing scientific research. They are doing the exploration tasks. They have some fun as well. You have the cupola, which was put up as a collaboration between the European Space Agency and NASA. And they, astronauts, like to spend a lot of time there looking down on the Earth and enjoy the view. When they go up, they carve out a corner of the station for themselves, and when they rest, they can barefoot themselves to the wall. They have to exercise for 2-3 hours a day, so you have to maintain your physiological and also psychological health. But ultimately, if you look at the bottom right image, it's a laboratory. It's not a habitat. It's habitat functionality, but it's a laboratory which is noisy, bright, is designed to do work, and the same as you would live and work in your office, and then everything has to be done at that place. So it's not necessarily ideal for a long-duration space mission. We have to rethink how we design these environments. So if you go to the next slide, Maslow has this hierarchy of needs. We start with basic needs, which talks about physiological needs, then go up to safety, and love and belonging, esteem, cognitive and aesthetic needs, self-actualization, and transcendence. So with our current engineering and technology-driven approach, we are very much addressing the psychological or the physiological needs, which are metabolic needs. You have the ecosystem on the space station. You will have to have that on the long-duration space mission as well. You have environmental protection. You have your space suit if you want to go outside the habitat. And we have to protect the astronauts. So you have the radiation shelter. You have system autonomy. You have sensors, communication systems, health monitoring. So these basic needs are very well addressed. Addressed through engineering, addressed through the human research program. And some of the psychological needs are also addressed. And astronauts are trained for this, like a tour of duty in the military. You go up, do your job, and come back. But once you get to a long-duration mission, which can take 1,100 days, and you're separated from Earth, suddenly you are very much on your own very often. So if anything happens, you have to be able to deal with it. Also, you have to deal with your emotional and psychological needs and self-actualization, creativity. None of these are currently addressed. So the point I was trying to make in this example is that once you get to a long-duration space mission, it's not enough to go operate in our current paradigm, which is engineering and technology-driven, as some human-centered, the human research program addresses some of that. We have to go beyond that and incorporate additional needs as well, higher-level needs as well. If you look at the next slide, 26, this is the example of the chair I built. It's a tensegravity chair, so it's only held together by rods and wires, so tension and rigidity holds them together. There are no joints. But the point here I was trying to make is that designers have to consider the environment. It's an extreme environment. They have to design for humans in that environment. It has to be a human-centered design. There has to be some obstruction. For example, you're isolated from Earth, but you may still want to have that element of Earth in the environment. So you cannot take a mountain with you, cannot take a lake with you, but maybe you can take some virtual reality environment with you that provides that feeling when you're exercising, you can, do some skiing downhill or something like that. It has to have certain affordances. You have to be able to do certain things with those objects that you have in the environment. And then you have to have signifiers, these are design terms, which guides the user to figure out what to do with those objects. For example, a signifier can be on the computer screen, your mouse. This is called the cursor. And you move it around. When you put it over a certain icon, the cursor can change. So that's a signifier, because it signifies that you can do something else here. So designers can provide affordances, so it allows the users to do something with it. And also they can build in signifiers that allows them to actually guide the user to figure out what they want to do with the object. You still have to worry about safety. You still have to worry about mass and volume considerations. You can play with the temporal and spatial dimensions, like open it up, close it down. It can be either autonomous, so you can use that. You can have this immersive environment. I was mentioning the virtual reality environment, which is very important to provide that connection back to Earth. You have to have a human connection between the astronauts, between the environment, and connection back to Earth. And we have to find ways how to communicate back from the habitat back to Earth. Then you have these separation time lags between communicating back and forth. So there are many elements. Emotional design is under consideration, multi-level storytelling. So many considerations designers can do that we are using currently on Earth for terrestrial designs that we can infuse into it. Unfortunately, there are no job categories within NASA for designers. There are a couple of designers, excellent designers who are working at NASA. They're also engineers. And what they are doing is they hire these engineers and then they kind of cross-pollinate and they bring their art to the work, and then they try to do something. But if there are no requirements for these higher-level needs, they are not incorporated into a design, and we have to work on that. If you go to the next slide, 27, so I mentioned that the long-duration space flight, we have to go beyond the current engineering and management and technology-driven approach, and it has to be a human-centered design approach. We don't have guidelines for that currently. So what we can do is maybe we can set up a couple of analog missions on Earth when we focus on these higher-level needs, and then from those experiences, try to derive some guidelines. Once you have the guidelines, we can translate them to requirements. But the important thing is not only that we have to have requirements, we have to have a forcing function from strategic leadership to say that we have to include these requirements into the mix. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. And that is the challenge when you have this first of the cybernetics approach, when project managers are staying within the paradigm. And if you go to them saying, I have this new idea to include human-centered design, the first thing will be, I don't have requirements for that. It's beyond the paradigm. We don't have money for this. We don't care about this. So if you think that it's really important to have human-centeredness in this long-duration space habitat, then we have to have this forcing function from strategic level to make sure that these are in the requirement set, and then we can make it happen. So the third example, the third structure point, is design environment and how we can utilize cybernetics and design dialogues in this environment. And this is a set of medals I did commemorating the Galileo mission and how Galileo discovered the Galileo moons, and 350 years later we went there with a Galileo mission, and we entered Jupiter with probes, with one probe, and exploited in situ, so how we extended our horizons. So go to the next slide, 29. This is a viable system model translation of JPL's organization. So we have NASA headquarters and working with JPL. Within JPL, we have program offices, we have line organizations, and within that, in between, there is an organization called the Innovation Foundry. And the Innovation Foundry is a performing organization who is getting funding from the program offices and then getting people and tools from the line organization. And the Innovation Foundry performs vision concept studies through the concept shop. And there we have the A-team, which is early stage concept maturity level, a CML 1 to 3, just similar to TRL range, which is TRL 1 to 9. CML is also 1 to 9, but it's applied to concepts, not to technologies. So A-team is doing CML 1 to 3, and then we can advance it further to TMAX, which is doing a point design, the feasibility. And at that point, we feel that, you know, the project probably is defined enough to propose it to NASA for funding. So then the proposal shop comes into play when they provide the environment to develop these proposals and then submit it to the program office, to NASA headquarters. And hopefully we get funding for that. The strategy shop is there to support JPL with strategic considerations. Now, within this environment, Typically, we have subject matter experts, as it is in every mission concept study everywhere else, at other NASA centers as well. But we also bring in designers, especially for the A-team and maybe for the proposal work, because designers can bring in new ideas. They can bring in this beyond the current paradigm considerations, and then they can introduce these ideas to the discourse, which is very important to find out what else can we do within paradigm. Subject matter experts can very often can say, well, I know exactly everything about this topic, and this one is never going to work. And at that point, there is no forward from that. You are logged into that way of thinking that this is the only way we can do certain things. If you bring in outside ideas before you cut it down, let's just explore those ideas and see what else can we do, and then later on bring in the subject matter experts, when they can say what can be done, what cannot be done, what technologies we have to develop to pull that in and then make that happen. If you go to the next slide, Paul Fangaro, who's a cybernetician, is one of my supervisors, came up with this co-evolutionary design approach. When he said, we have to have a conversation about agreeing on the goals. And we are doing that now, so we agree on the goals. We have the conversation about agreeing on the means. We also have a conversation about designing the design. And then we have to have, we have to develop new languages. And new languages are developed by having these conversations. So what happens is, you bring in these ideas from different areas, from different topics, different disciplines, and by conversing, you come up with a new meaning, with new ideas, with new possibilities. And once you have this common new meaning, which goes beyond the existing paradigm, that can provide new possibilities, new opportunities. So if you go to the next slide, is the line still working? Hello?
Yep, doing fine.
Okay, good. No, I just you know, it was very quiet, so I was hoping that, you know, that didn't disconnect. So next slide, 31, is showing this kind of dialogues, but through a boundary object. And the boundary object is an object that is in between disciplines. This object shows that I developed this using science, engineering, design, and art, through the development process, but during the development, I was a designer, created this object, and I created it through this circularity of sense-giving and sense-making. So I did something with a prototype, a version of it, and then I looked at it. When I looked at it, I saw it very differently from, you know, a different angle, or it didn't work out, or something came back next day, and I interpreted it differently. And then I made another iteration, try to come up with a slightly modified version. So I had this circular dialogue between me and an object. So I created this object through sense-giving and sense-making. Once it was created, and I showed it to people, they were the observers, they also go through the circularity. They look at it, so they try to make sense of it, what it is, and they try to interpret it. Does it fit into the understanding or not? So they may have to resample it or go through the circular sampling process through sense-giving and sense-making. And then, in a way, we have a discussion, a dialogue between the designer and the observer. So I can provide this information to the observer, and the observer can actually provide feedback to me, and then we can refine our understanding over the object, and they would understand what I was trying to do, or I can understand what kind of ideas this object initiated. So this kind of boundary object can be very helpful in design environments. When you try to come up with new concepts and you build a mock-up of a spacecraft saying, I decided to have the solar panels here and put it together from Legos and toothpicks and bits and pieces of paper. But then you can have the boundary object as a center of the conversation. And through the conversation, you can refine the model, you can refine the ideas, and you can figure out, you know, how things could work or not work. So the circles around here just show that when I went through the ideation phase, science of fluid flow, computational fluid modeling, flow visualization, prototyping. I used different parts of these disciplines. Started out with science, then I included some engineering, then some design and art, and eventually ended up with a bronze sculpture, which incorporated all of these disciplines. And I can go to engineers, talk about the art side, to artists talking about the engineering side, and through this dive, through this object, I can facilitate these dialogues. But these objects are not necessarily the only type of objects. If you go to the next slide, you can use posters, visual communication as well as boundary objects. These are the posters I did, some of them I did for the International Planetary Book Workshop. And this is just to explain to people what the conference, the workshop is about, and try to attract people to the conference. But it is part of visual storytelling. You can use visual communications through Keystone graphics. When you capture a mission concept in a very nicely assembled visual, because a picture speaks a thousand words. So you don't have to have 10, 20 pages of explanation of what it is if a nice image can capture it. And these are the areas where designers can play a significant role to help us to communicate our message better, to tell our story better. Because ultimately, these proposals, for example, are sales documents. And you may be able to explain it to another engineer very clearly, but not everybody is a subject matter expert in your area. So you have to capture the meaning of your story in a way that other people from the review board can understand it very clearly, and you can develop it into quite of an art. And the JPL is very successful. The Innovation Foundry's proposals shop is very successful to put these proposals together by not only using subject matter experts for the teams, but also bringing in these designers who can help translate these messages in a way that we can communicate them more effectively. So if you go to the next slide. So the point is designers play a very important role, or can play a very important role, on how to communicate our message within teams, how to communicate among each other, and they can be facilitators in these dialogues within team environments, but also how to communicate to stakeholders, to sponsors, to the public. And not only having conversations about this inside or outside, but we can use props. We can use these boundary objects to help us further explain, further communicate these ideas. And then through these conversations, we can develop new languages. And once we have this new common meaning that we develop among ourselves, which goes beyond our current paradigm of engineering and technology, then those new ideas can provide new options and can lead to new preferable outcomes. So in conclusion, I use cybernetics to have a perspective on how to see things. And I use design to figure out what to do about them. And cybernetic dialogues are very important to come to this constructivist middle ground, to understand what you are trying to do, your understanding what you're trying to do, and your environment's understanding what you're trying to convey. So this one is working every scale, as I demonstrated, working from the object scale to organizational scales. But dialogues are important, language is important, and hopefully it can provide new options for NASA. So that's pretty much it. One more little pitch. We are working also with a documentary with a colleague of mine, and hopefully it will be ready by the end of this summer, also titled Design Square for Space Design. A year ago, we went over to NASA. We interviewed people at NASA headquarters, at JPL and the Johnson Space Center. And it was part of my research, but also we had excellent footage when talked to space architects and designers and senior leadership and managers, project managers and program executives. And they provided very important insights about how design can help NASA to go to advance further our discourse. So thank you very much. And please let me know if you have any questions.
Thank you, Tibor. This is Harley. And, yeah, a question. This is coming from, I think it's really an insightful question. Well, I hope it's insightful. Coming from, sent me an email from one of the interns that I mentioned earlier on. And I can't tell if it's a he or she, but he or she asked whether or not if the medium by which you communicate plays a role. Here you gave basically a PowerPoint, a PDF. Fairly straightforward
yes.
type of presentation.
Yes.
Does the communication, face-to-face, lecture style, Twitter, Facebook, the range of
yes.
media work better for you or not?
It's a very good question. And as I pointed out, one example was a sculpture. Other example were posters. I was talking about film. But anything that you can use to communicate the message and start a conversation, start a dialogue, and then through the conversation come to this common understanding is important. So there is no one solution for this. PowerPoint is not it, that's for sure. PowerPoint reduces cognitive storytelling into linear bullet points and doesn't capture the complexities of the issues. And this caused a lot of trouble in the past as well. And, you know, we are very much stuck in that paradigm. But yes, new and new ideas how to communicate can be very helpful. And as I said, we are not limited to PowerPoint and PDF. It was very convenient at this stage because of the distances, and then it's a telecom-based colloquium, so everybody can look at it and we can follow the storytelling. And also, it requires a lot of effort how to present the story in a different format. But that's why we can bring in, again, the designers, because they are very familiar with different types of storytelling. And they are not limited to PowerPoint or limited to Excel spreadsheets or they are limited to a Word document. And the clarity of the information is important. The circularity, the interaction about getting feedback from your communication, you understand it, they understood it better. And you can say that, well, let's talk about the tree. And you can say, well, what kind of tree are you talking about? You're talking about like a big bushy tree? I said, no, you're talking about a big pointed tree. Like, you mean like a summery pointy tree in Italy? Like, no, like another pointy tree with a spiky thing in the Scandinavia. Like, oh, you mean a pine tree? And suddenly through this dialogue, you converge down to a common meaning. Now, you both know that when I'm talking about the tree, I'm talking about the pine tree. But if I will say that, you know, I'm talking about the tree, your cognitive model will picture something that you believe that is I'm talking about. And if you have a misunderstanding, that can take us down a path when you think I'm saying something and I think I'm saying something and we are talking about totally different things. So yes, it's very important what medium you use, how to communicate and how to maintain this dialogue to refine that meaning so you both understand what you meant to convey.
Got it.
A long explanation.
I have a follow-up question, but I'd like to give, since we're coming up to the top of the hour, although you may be able to stay a while longer, do other folks have questions?
Tibor, this is Dan Lester. That was really interesting. Thank you very much. I wanted to look at your slide 19, where you gave an organizational diagram of PAFD, which looked very nice and looked very sensible. And then I want to compare that with your slide 11, which was sort of the organization the way it is now, which you referred it to as spatially and temporally coupled and therefore a cyclical wicked problem. And I'm wondering to what extent your organization in slide 19, because it does have a lot of these loops that go around and around, why isn't that a cyclical, wicked problem?
It can be. In fact, it can be. I'm not saying, but the Space Tech Mission Directorate, as it was applied to it, it's like a self-contained bubble. Let's say that we have, well, it's cyclical, and you have the temporal nature of it because every year you get the budget. You have the spatial nature because the program was done at Langley for space technology, for game changing for my program, my ex program. And then, but the projects were all over the country. You have the annual budget that is changing all the time. So all of those elements are there. So it is also a big problem. And, the interesting thing is a strategic leadership has to make decisions about what technologies to invest. The projects would like to perform and try to do the best they try to do, develop certain kind of technologies. But those can change. So even though you're doing a very good job, senior leadership can say, we are cutting your project, and you don't understand, you know, why is it cut? I'm doing a great job. And this is because other strategic considerations impacted the thing. For example, a good example for that is Mars 2020. Mars 2020 was a possibility to try certain technologies that we were developing, and then Planetary decided to refly MSL, which meant that most of the technologies were heritage technologies. So there was no room to insert these new technologies. So therefore, the question from strategic level was, now, do we still keep investing into these technologies right now when we have limited money, or we have to refocus on something else that we need in the near term and then revisit these technologies when we can actually fly? So why invest now? That's a question in innovation, like why invest now? And then you have to make a strategic choice. Do you have a short-term need, a long-term need, and what is the tactical solution, what is the strategic solution? And that, again, makes it a very complex problem. And those drivers from a strategic level are very different from the expectations from the project level or the program office level. So you can see that there's a different level of different drivers, and there's no one solution for this, but everybody's right. You just have to take one direction, and then end up with an outcome.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. I was also going to say that in your PAFD organization chart, I really like the fact that your boxes are defined by tasks. That is, the boxes specifically say what is happening there, rather than these odd names like, you know, directorate or project manager or stuff like that, which are not really task specific. So this helps. Thank you.
Yeah. So that's why you have to do these conversations about things. Not, it doesn't really matter what your title is, but you have to have these circular dialogues between organizations, between the boxes, and then you have to focus those dialogues, those conversations on the relevant topic areas.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Question. Have you drawn any parallels to a system of systems approach for, you know, complex systems, interactive systems, et cetera?
Interesting what you're saying. Donatella Meadows wrote a book on system of systems, and cybernetics is very close related to system of systems. So you see the feedbacks, the circularity, control systems, and in fact, the whole system of systems is originated from cybernetics, and all the disciplines were spinning off, and a navigation system, control system, engineering system, system of systems, there are many elements within different disciplines which took the best part of cybernetics and incorporated and grew within their own paradigm and advanced it further. So yes, you're right. There are many overlaps between system of systems and the cybernetics. But the challenge here is that system of systems is developed within NASA, within engineering paradigm. So in that case, the language that is developed is getting very logged in to that paradigm. So what my argument here is that if you are stuck in that paradigm, you want to introduce anything new, then you have to maybe introduce some new disciplines, such as design and cybernetics, and broaden it out again. And then within that, you see, it doesn't replace your system of systems approach, but you broaden it. And because you broaden it, you have like three sticks, you can do so many things with it. You add one more stick to it, you have more options. So in that case, you can maybe come up with some other ideas. So I'm not giving a cookie cutter solution. If you do this, you will have a better option. What I'm saying, I'm offering approaches that if you follow up on, maybe we can introduce new possibilities that currently is beyond our paradigm.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, I have a follow-up to that question, actually. This is Mark Schellhammer. Until recently, I was the chief scientist for the human research program at NASA, and a lot of what you've described early on as a linear, somewhat unrealistic linear approach to problems and breaking them down into easy, conventional pathways is a deficiency in the way that we're approaching things in HRP, or at least how we have been. We have, for example, 32 specific risks that we address that we're trying to mitigate. I gave a FISO talk about this about 3 years ago myself. But it's occurred to us, especially to me recently, that these risks all interact with each other. They interact with the design of the vehicle. They interact with the mission requirements. They interact with a number of things. And this might better be formulated, in our case, as a complex adaptive system, which is a form of a system of systems, a form of a cybernetic system. So I wonder if you've looked at, if you've looked into formulating it in that manner as well, the complex adaptive systems approach pioneered by the Santa Fe Institute, who we've talked to a number of times, trying to get them interested in looking at our problems this way.
I haven't looked into that yet, but the interesting thing about this is NASA's projects are, you know, millions, tens or hundreds, millions or billion-dollar projects. And you have the system of systems, and you're breaking down subsystems, and everybody is trying to control their own domain. They are very keen on making the best possible solution for that subsystem, and they go up to system of systems and build it up. Everybody puts a little bit of margin into it, and then by the time you build up your final system of systems, you are so heavy and so overpowered because of all the added margins that you won't be able to actually launch it. So in the real world, you have architects and designers with an umbrella function to oversee this. and trying to introduce a chief architect within NASA would be one solution, but I don't really see how the culture would allow to do something like that, like a von Braun kind of character who would, from the top down, from umbrella function, would just organize the whole thing together, just like an architect would do it. And then under that, you can optimize the system more effectively. Because right now we have this fragmented system and everybody's working with each other. But they always, you know, once you add up all of their constraints, you end up with a sometimes over-constrained system. But I haven't looked into adaptive systems yet.
Yeah, it's a clear example in my mind of a complex adaptive system. A number of things spatially and temporally distributed, all interacting, and there are emergent properties. There are things that come out of these interactions, both positive and negative things, that you wouldn't expect by looking at them one at a time. So at the moment, I have high hopes for that approach.
And that's another difference with designers versus engineers, because engineers can march down and develop the technology in the very end, and you get it done, and you end up with something that you may not want. Probably you want it, but maybe it's not the most optimal, but you ended up with something. And designers are going through more of the iterative process. But the counter argument for that is when you have a multi-hundred-million-dollar mission, you don't have the time and the resources to do the iterations that the designers, so you can do it on a smaller scale, but maybe it's not as simple for a larger scale. So how to reconcile this is kind of a challenge.
Yeah, best to consider it right from the start.
Yeah. And well, that's the other idea, is some of these things like human-centeredness. You cannot build a habitat that is, engineering functional, and at the very end you say, okay, well, now let's just put some human-centeredness into it. You won't be able to retrofit it. And then you don't have money and time to actually go back to the starting point and then redesign it from that concept, from that perspective as well. So you have to have some of these considerations, requirements for the early start, including the design, and then design it with it. Otherwise, it's very hard to make it into the system.
Okay, Tibor, this is Harley again. Do you have time for, if there are, a couple of other questions?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Folks, again, here's an opportunity. Questions? Any other questions for Tibor? Okay, great. Tibor, thank you. I think it was an excellent presentation. And it did seem to get something that I particularly care about, as I said, gets our younger scientists and engineers who come in and listen to these FISO telecons, gets them energized, broadens their experience. So, again, thank you so much. And talk to you all next Wednesday.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and thanks for the opportunity.